part of the fascination of the story of Stanford AI Lab is that some of the more lasting contributions that came from there are, in fact, these tools of people interacting, utilities that allowed people to communicate with each other, finger, early chat programs. And it's amusing that the things that people do for fun have such a long lifetime and a lasting influence, whereas the formal research work of the laboratory doesn't loom very large in anyone's mind nowadays.
Yeah.
It's once again people not creating personal computers, not creating hardware because they wanted it, but creating these interactive tools because they wanted to use them.
Yeah, that's very striking. It was Les Ernest, who was the number two guy to John McCarthy at the Stanford AI Lab, who created the program called Finger. And he created Finger just because it was, I think part of the story was, it was hard to find people when they wanted to go out and get Chinese meal late at night. They needed to know where they were. And so it was a useful tool that just had to keep the community going. Now, that said, I find it a very interesting time also in terms of those traditional AI technologies that were pioneered at SAIL in the 60s and failed. When they started the lab in 1963 or 1964, they believed that it would take a decade to create a working artificial intelligence. I mean, that is a sentient creature that could interact with human beings. Well, they were off by a couple hundred years, but or whatever. And then in the mid-1980s, there was this period called the AI winter, where there had been a whole set of companies to come out of this idea that you could do useful things, reasoning systems and what have you, vision systems, and they all failed. And that was called the AI winter. But now we're back in this really remarkable period where it's no longer called artificial intelligence. It's called machine intelligence or machine learning, but they're successfully doing the things they failed to do in the 60s. I think it's going to have a huge impact on society, and that whole debate is going to sneak up on us just when we thought it had gone away. The Stanford AI Lab has been recreated at Stanford. Last year, the Stanley, which was a Stanford robot car, won the DARPA Grand Challenge. The significance of that feat has been underappreciated by the world at large. I mean, a machine was able to drive itself over some of the worst roads in the world for 150, 160 miles successfully without crashing. I mean, that's a big deal. You look at lots and lots of little areas. They've broken away from these things that they built, these things called expert systems, and they're using statistical techniques, and they're being very successful. A company like Tellme, for example, that does operator assistance. This is based on voice recognition. When Tellme first started answering calls, an 800 directory assistant, they were getting about 12% of them without human interaction. Now they're up over 70%. That you look around in all these little areas and they're making progress in areas that used to be called artificial intelligence. Nobody calls it artificial intelligence anymore. All the legacy of SAIL, the Stanford AI Lab.
Before reading what the Dormouse said, I was unaware of the importance of Greek folk dancing in the history of computing.
There was a scene, I remember this as a kid actually, and there was a big folk dancing scene, not just Greek, but all kinds. I mean, I'm not a good enough anthropologist to know all the different variants of folk dancing, but what I have a very clear memory of, was it Saturday nights on the second floor of Trester Union at Stanford in the 70s? There was a very lively folk dancing scene. And, of course, Doug Engelbart met his wife through the folk dancing scene that was around the Mid-Peninsula. I don't know where it was exactly, somewhere in the Palo Alto area during the 50s. So, you know, somebody else is going to have to chronicle the actual folk dancing community. But it's still around. So it's time for another book, I think. I'm trying to find another book project, and I've sort of run through a bunch of ideas, and nothing feels right. I think the obvious weakness of Dormouse is there were too many stories. I mean, I wanted to capture all kinds of stories, but what a lot of people say is that there are so many stories they lose track of the characters. And what's really fun as a writer is to tell a single story. And so I'm looking for a single story. Satomo Shimomura's capture of Kevin Mitnick was a single story, and it was just so easy to write because the story told itself. But you only stumble across really great stories. I mean, or at least I do as a reporter. I don't stumble across them often enough, I guess.
Well, tell us about your other book since you just started.
Going all the way back, first book I wrote was called The High Cost of High Tech. Before I became a reporter, I was actually around here as a political activist during the 1960s and 1970s when I grew up here. And I worked at a group which is still sort of around called Pacific Study Center, which grew out of the Stanford anti-war movement. And with Lenny Siegel, who was a longtime Silicon Valley activist, we wrote a book called The High Cost of High Tech. that was looking at sort of the consequences of the industry, which was sort of being celebrated in the 80s, and there were some downsides. Quality of life in Silicon Valley was and still is suspect occasionally. There was probably more air pollution back then. There was certainly the phenomenon of having to have two wage earners to survive in Silicon Valley. What's amazed me in the intervening two decades is how resilient the Valley is. As tough as it is, it still seems to be surviving.
The other story that I think has to be told is what really happened out here in 2001.
I agree. You know, the one survey book, it was a good book, but it was called .con, mm-hmm. which was an attempt to do that. But it doesn't capture the human face that you're speaking about, because that definitely was there. And, you know, we're back in good times. Everybody's forgotten, right? That's one of the natures of, no, people haven't forgotten. You're right. Now,
some of us still have scars, big ones.
Yeah. It's still a boom and bust economy.
Yeah.
You know, that part of it hasn't changed. And our memories are very short, at least the people who jump back in, and everybody's all spun up again. You can just feel it. The jobs haven't all come back.
Yes.
The way.
So here's another story that has to be told. The employability of people with PhDs and 20 to 30 years of experience is drying up. And that's a very ugly story that needs to be told.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I have very clear memories from being in high school in Palo Alto. And I don't remember the exact year, but there was a mass layoff at NASA Ames related to the cancellation of some space program. And boy, it had an impact on a whole generation of engineers. At that point, the sort of commercial valley was not as big a part of Silicon Valley as it is now. The government and defense part was much bigger, and that was a boom and bust economy on its own rate. And when those jobs went away, it destroyed people's lives.